Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to another edition of The Layover on the Lost In Network. We've got an exciting guest to talk with you guys today. Tom Merchant is the co-founder of Black Tomato, the award-winning luxury travel company known for designing deeply immersive, emotionally driven travel experiences around the world. He leads the brand's business development, marketing, and creative strategy, helping position Black Tomato as one of the most innovative voices in modern travel. A recognized thought leader in luxury and experiential travel, Tom serves on advisory boards for brands including Six Sense Hotels and Kurzner International. And he regularly contributes to trend forecasting on the future of travel and speaks globally at conferences and institutions such as Google and Harvard. His work has been widely featured in leading media, and he has been recognized by Condé Nast Traveler and the World Luxury Chamber of Commerce for his impact on the industry. Tom, thanks so much for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me on, Sean. It's Dylan, rather. It's really... It's good to be on, actually, hearing that recount of all that stuff we do is both humbling and slightly embarrassing, but it's nice.
Well, hey, it's it sounds good in a bio, right?
yeah.
You know, I know I just wrapped off quite a bit there, but, you know, a lot of our travel audience is interested in kind of how people got into the industry. Do you want to maybe take us back a little bit? Tell us a little bit about, you know, where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? What did you study? You know, what was travel like for you as a, you know, as a young person growing up, and why did it become such a important part of your life where you wanted to spend the rest of your life giving other people those experiences?
Yeah, no, it's, well, I'd love to. It's funny because you often reflect on, like, sometimes I'm not sure everyone does it. How did I get to here? And you look back and wonder where the moments might have been that fueled that. And I think it's a couple of reasons. I mean, I grew up in Birmingham in England, which I think has become kind of globally famous since Peaky Blinders came out. I think before that, it wasn't so well known. So now when I say it, there's a reference. I don't have the accent, but I can, I certainly know the area well. But grew up in Birmingham, but my mother's from Finland, and she trained as a nurse in Finland and worked in Sweden and traveled a lot and sort of ended up in Worcestershire, which is just south of Birmingham, on her travels and met my father. And so growing up there, I think my mother's love of travel and just the fact that I had relatives away in Scandinavia led to sort of summers in Finland and lots of exploring around Europe. And my father's side of the family had sort of lived all over the world. So I had uncles sort of spread around the world, and my father traveled a lot with work. So I think around the home, there was always a big interest in travel, which fueled a curiosity in myself and my brother. And growing up, I was always really eager to know what else was beyond almost like the confines of where I live, almost like my country as well. And, you know, we didn't go on crazy holidays all over the world, but it was just regular sort of summers into Southern Europe, like I say, up in Scandinavia in summers and winter as well. And I think at a young age, I was so blown away by just the idea of meeting different cultures and different people. And I think it was in those early days, without realizing it, probably the seed was planted, which has led to what I'm doing now. I then studied at university in a town in the northeast of England called Newcastle, and met my partner, my business partner, James Merritt, there. We both studied geography, which people say, oh, well, that was natural that you go into travel. But if I'm honest, we liked studying it. It was less about capitals and mountains, but more about human and socioeconomic kind of stuff in geography. But we reconnected over a love of sport and travel, actually, James and I did. And so every sort of spare moment we had when we were at college, we sort of worked double jobs to earn money. And then when the summers or the holidays came, we'd take off on adventures around the world, just trying to explore new places and really looking for places that weren't the obvious places. You know, a lot of people in the UK, when they turn up at university or when they leave university, would take what we call gap years. And it was often the regular travels to great places like, you know, Australia and Thailand. And we were always looking for something else. So the first trip I remember we took was to the Philippines when we were 19. And in those days, it wasn't really known, that well known beyond things like, you know, the Marcos regime and all this stuff. And that first trip, we spent about 3 months in the Philippines, just backpacking around it, riding motorbikes across islands, hitching rides on fishing boats, working routes to get between islands. And we just fell in love with this idea of exploring and looking and searching for feelings that we were desperate to get from travel. And to accelerate that forward, yeah, James and I, both of our fathers were entrepreneurs. And so we'd grown up in households where we'd observed our our dads working hard, having the lows, but the highs, but seeing the satisfaction they got from having their own thing. And so on one of our many trips, we'd said, you know, we wanted to do something together. We didn't know what it was, but our kind of fundamental requirement was it had to be something we were passionate about. Because we subscribe to the adage, which some people don't, which is, you know, this idea that don't work on something you love because you'll fall out of love with it. And ours is, well, actually, ours was the opposite, which was work on something you love and then it'll never feel like a job. And also, if you like, the passion you have for it will carry you through the tougher times because you're so dialed into and so full of belief for what you do. And so it was on these travels, we're in Brazil in the Pantanal, in the which is a huge area in the middle of Brazil, kind of half the size of France, but incredible diversity, you know, swampland, jungles, you know, lakes full of piranhas and crocodiles, swamps you walk through, you're making sure you don't kind of tread an anaconda, you know, sleeping out in huts, you know, with snakes in the rafters. And it was one night where we said, how do we keep doing this? You know, I mean, the honest answer was, how do we keep doing this? Because we love it. And is there a business in this? And, you know, fast forward a little bit, we came back, we met our third business partner when we were traveling Australia, and a guy called Matt Smith, and he was cut from a very similar cloth to us. We came back to London. We all took jobs in the corporate world, not because we weren't sure what we wanted to do, but rather we thought getting some experience, even though it wasn't necessarily directly transferable, but just the idea of working in a commercial enterprise where you get skills in terms of negotiating or meeting people would be good. So we did that for a few years. And over those 3-4 years, we shaped what was becoming Black Tomato. And it allowed us to see what our colleagues and friends and connections were thinking about with regards to travel. And actually that period just really reinforced our belief in what the proposition of Black Tomato was going to be, which was very much in the, I mean, now we call it the experiential kind of approach, but back in those days, people didn't talk about travel that way, which is where we saw an opportunity to sort of light the fire under our kind of business dreams.
I love it. Great story. When did you guys start to think about this idea of the luxury market? Because a lot of those early days of what you're talking about is a lot of backpacking and motorbiking and staying in mud huts on the side of the river. Not what everybody would always, you know, those experiences can be exciting and fun and transformational, but you know, there's a luxury element that, you know, your clientele probably expects from those experiences where they're not roughing it so much, maybe.
Yeah.
So when did you start thinking about the idea of experiential travel, but also curating an ecosystem of partners which could really provide that ultimate black glove service, you know, that you get from the type of clientele that you guys are catering to?
It's a really good question, Dylan. I think ultimately it was an evolution. Like, I think our view still is that, you know, there are many luxury takes on many different forms. And, you know, there are, we cater to a, you know, a high net worth audience, and there are the, I'm air quoting, the classic kind of types of luxury that people want. But the stuff we were doing in the early days and the places we were going to and finding, which were hard to access, quite unknown, gave you that unique feeling, made you feel special because you're enjoying something that few others had, or you'd had to work harder. That actually started falling into quite a luxury category. It wasn't something that was easily available or everyone had. And you know, I always talk about this time we went to Iceland as we were planning the business. And I mean, it's well known now, but in those days, there's this lake outside Reykjavik, and off the lake there's this fissure called the Silfra Crack, and it's clear water, but it's very cold. But you can basically, the clearest water in the world, like clearer than the water you'll scuba dive in the Maldives, but you can dive down between it, down this fissure, and hold one hand on the Americana plate and one hand on the Eurasian plate and sort of be holding the world apart, right? And this experience, that was only, I think, you know, probably like 70, 80 euros. It didn't conform to this conventional luxury definition, but it was a luxury because people didn't know about it and it gave you this unique experience. So that was an element. But then I think we always knew the market. We had a lot of, it wasn't that we came from an Uber luxury background or had a whole treasure chest of capital to go out and throw at this, but we were working around people in demanding jobs who were cash rich, time poor, but who still yearn to have a sense of, you know, to find these amazing feelings they're looking for, but do that in a way that also would throw in comfort as well. So that, you know, we don't always have, people don't have the luxury of just putting a backpack on your back and taking off for 10 months as much as some people like, but it's saying, well, if I took 2 weeks off, I'd love to stay in great places. So that's comfortable, but what adventures can I have around it? Or actually I may forego spending X amount on a suite, but I'll spend that same amount getting deep into the Mongolian steppe where I can sleep under a starlit sky that I can read by on Hessian mats, because the feeling of uniqueness is going to give me is just as special. So as we offer these types of experiences, but built relationships with incredible hotel providers and property places and partners who understood our market, so the offering, it didn't kind of evolve without us knowing it. It just moved into this space where we still allowed and encouraged people to look for experiences, but also knowing that they could do it at a level of comfort where they wouldn't be thinking, well, if I get back from that, I'm going to need another 3 weeks off work to recover.
The classic vacation from the vacation.
It's like every ski trip I take, you know, it's always like I need another week off. But so it was, we knew the audience because we were working around them in our jobs. And, you know, we were still young, and it's, you know, I think a lot of people, when they're looking to kind of understand audiences, you don't always have to be from that world when you start, but you need to be able to understand it. And, you know, now we have thousands of, you know, premium, high level premium customers, you know, around the world traveling us all the time. And we really understand what makes them tick and what matters to them. But they all share a common thread, which is a level of curiosity and a desire to, you know, experience places in a way that is not the obvious. So to take the side street that others people won't, to go a bit further, you know, into that landscape, to go to the other mountain, to pick the lake on the horizon, to wander over to that place and meet these people that you wouldn't from a guidebook. And that's been a real joy, actually, starting to kind of work with and build a fantastic community of like-minded, curious people.
I love that. So, you know, I feel like everybody nowadays in travel, they're chasing, you know, the trends they find on social media, right? We've found this concept of over-tourism.
Yeah.
You know, something happens, whether it's, you know, the White Lotus effect in Bali, or, you know, on kind of like mainstream entertainment, or you have a video that goes viral on TikTok about, you know, Albania, for instance.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden that's the hotspot. And then you show up and you've got like five guys next to you in the water, and it's like you're like arm to arm and there's no infrastructure, and Albania just started serving tours in the 80s and they don't have the infrastructure.
Yes.
So how do you guys as premium, you know, curators find these kind of off the beaten path, these life transformational travel opportunities that are still kind of the undiscovered, untapped, that haven't been bastardized by social media or the latest travel film?
It is fascinating, the increasing influence of not just media, but drama upon travel. I mean, we've always, actually as a company, we've always believed that you travel often subconsciously, but as a manifestation of your other passions. And so it will be things where, you know, you might be reading a book that's not about a place, but it's set in a place and it just starts making you think, or you're watching a show. I mean, there's the White Lotus effect, but you could take that all the way back to Lord of the Rings in New Zealand, right? When people start seeing, and I've seen over the years, because it's become a backdrop for everything from Game of Thrones to Interstellar. And whilst that's great for those places, and it is lovely to make that connection. So we like, you know, even like if someone's favorite band just recorded an album out in a particular desert, you know, so we look for these connections to bring them out. But you also do come up against certain places, the White Lotus effect. You know, we work with all the places, you know, we know well kind of the hordes that have run into Sicily, you know, and it's a challenge. And because exactly as you say, there's reality versus almost like the fantasy. And over tourism, yeah, Iceland's a great example. I love Iceland. It's probably my favorite country in the world. But most people's pictures, you know, it makes out that this landscape, and it's just you, there's no one else there. and you have this image of isolation, but what they do is they either use the benefits of photoshopping or stuff to get rid of the coach behind them. It's difficult from travel side, because the way some people market travel is you're always setting people up for a fall. But we have this phrase inside the company, which is that, you know, the world may have been discovered, but it hasn't been fully explored. And what that means is there are places like Iceland, as an example, that have vast stretches of hinterlands and valleys and mountains that people just don't know about, because it might not be on the classic route, but because of our relationships there and our partners and our fixers, that's where we take people to. And so, yes, there might be a classic part of it that someone has to tick off, but we'll get you deep into that place that others don't know about. So you're getting a more genuine and more personalized experience. The same in, you know, stretches of the Amalfi Coast, you know, like people will all gravitate to a certain place, that picture, because they've seen it, you know, 1,000 times, but they're jostling with the crowds. But we're like, just come with us, walk a kilometer down this road, come into this cave, and you're going to have something for yourself. And it's not just about the capturing of the media. It's about something that feels so much more particular to you. So it's you experiencing it on your own or with fewer people there, which is a great feeling that people look for in travel, but also it makes you feel like you're getting the inside track on something. So to do that, that just requires a level of curiosity within our company and our team and our product developers and our partners on the ground who understand what we're looking for. And in there, you can kind of create travel gold. And so it's, you know, that Switzerland's a classic case, right? So Switzerland in the summer it has so many tourists. I mean, it's I think it almost has more than it does in the winter. And they go to the Jungfrau and the Matterhorn, and they're stunning, but there's coach loads of people everywhere. But there are great other parts of Switzerland. It's one of our tips for this year about destinations to go to, where are just not known, but only the locals know. These beautiful valleys that are like the epicenter of amazing Swiss cheese making and hikes, and places down near Ticino on the Italian border, which are just as stunning, but don't have anything like the crowds there. And so you're getting this, the experience you'll have in the other place, but so much more, with so much more meaning and less stress. It's a challenge. And in a way, I love how cultural platforms, you know, act as a catalyst to encourage people to travel. That's great. You know, and we have definitely seen, you know, we see the spikes in the destinations that the White Lotus names. I think it's just, has it just named Saint-Tropez is the next one.
Probably.
Yeah, so I always wonder how many tourist boards are just competing to...
at this point, it must be. I mean,
yeah,
the Four Seasons really lucked out with that partnership.
Yeah, they did. So it's a challenge, but it's an opportunity as well for us to show sort of how we think and how you can still get, you know, really amazing experiences out of places that to some people might feel are done or can't be done in another way.
I love it. I'm a big fan of brand origin as well. Can you tell me more about why the name Black Tomato and where did that
strange,
come from?
The strange name. After university, I took a secondment at a company in London just to earn a bit of cash before I was going to go traveling. And second week in, they said, did I want to go to Moscow? Because it's a tech company. They're buying a company over there. And I was... you know, I would just say yes to anything if it came to travel. So I said yes, and I was just going to go. I didn't speak Russian. I couldn't even read Russian, which led to some slightly hilarious journeys on the Moscow Underground, because I couldn't tell what stop I was going to be going to. End up on the other side of Moscow. But I went, and I was working at this company, and what was meant to be a couple of weeks turned into about 6 months there. And I really, you know, it's a tragedy in terms of what's happened to Russia now and that, but at the time, I was just blown away by the might of this country. Like, Moscow is so imposing, but culturally and socially decadent. It was a fascinating place. And so friends would come out and visit me, and we built great relationships with people over there. And then myself and James and Matt would go to Moscow looking at it as a place that we could offer. And it was on one of those trips, we were in a restaurant, ironically, it was a Ukrainian restaurant deep in the middle of Moscow. And it had this setup where, sounds very random, but you like sit around a farm. And so it was on levels, but in the middle of this restaurant was like a sort of farm bit where they had goats and sheep and chickens wandering around. I mean, it wasn't a kind of picky dinner, but it was this rustic place. Anyway, on the menu in there was a black tomato. And we didn't know what that was. Asked the waiter, what is that? And he gave a very passionate speech about it being this rare form of tomato, but when you taste it, it's an incredible experience. And it just sort of stuck in our head. So when we were thinking about what we were going to call the company, we decided we wanted to be the black tomato of travel. So offering these rare quality experiences. So yeah, that's where it came from. And also, you know, the company was bootstrapped. You know, we've still to this day never taken investment. And, you know, in those days we wanted to, you know, provoke, at least establish some intrigue. I mean, you could argue against it because it definitely doesn't say what we offer, but it at least kind of captured people's attention and they wanted to know more. And then once we had them looking at the site and talking to us, it allowed us to sort of sell them in on how we think about travel.
How was the tomato?
Yeah, this is the bit where I meant to say, like, it was good. I mean, if I turn around and said it's terrible, I never have one again. It would sort of brand down. But no, it was great. And it's funny, subsequently over the years, you know, they black tomatoes pop up like in places like the supermarket did a run on them, I think, for Valentine's Day a couple of years ago because they decided it was an aphrodisiac. And I always get random things from people around the world going, oh, I've seen this. But yeah, it was good. It was good.
I love it. So you guys were early, like very early to this, you know, new travel trend of transformational travel or the transformation economy. Essentially, the modern traveler wants the Eat, Pray, Love experience of Julia Roberts. They want to go on a trip and come back transformed in some way. They want to feel like they're a new person because they've had a cultural experience or they've seen something that is, you know, that they never expected to see. Yeah. They feel like they've been transformed by giving back to a local community. They may have taken some psychedelics in a hut somewhere. Why do you think this trend of transformational travel is so in vogue right now? And what are people looking for? And how do you deliver it in a way that is authentic? And I hate that as a buzzword, yeah, but it has to be used in certain contexts. Like, you know, like I'll give an example. Like you talked about Philippines, and I spent 8 days in the Philippines for the first time over the holiday. And you know, one of my colleagues was like, "All right, we're going to this place and we're going to swim with the whale sharks." And I'm like, "Oh, that's so cool." You know, you've seen all those pictures on social media.
Yeah.
And then you get there and it's literally like industrial whale sharks swimming. Like it's like there's 20 boats out with 50 yeah. people and you've got guys that are chumming the water.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this can't be good for the whales. They're never yeah. going to eat anything naturally ever again. You know, but the photos make it look like you're out there diving with whale sharks in the real world, you know, or in the wild somewhere. So how do you keep transformation transformative and yeah. not create a commodity out of it?
Yeah, Trade Descriptions Act and all that. Look, I think in terms of why you know, this word transformation and travel are being used so sort of side by side, it's a combination of reasons. I think partly it's almost factors outside of the travel industry itself. I think just, you know, the general population in the last 10 years has just started taking far more interest in about their personal well-being. I don't just mean health, I mean mental and, you know, whether it's at home, you know, or reading or just in their, through their curiosity. So there's a collective growing focus on how to feel better, be better. You know, if we could get into Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but everyone's sort of, well, how do I progress? And I think there's it's an okay, open conversation to have. You know, I think I say that as a Brit. You know, I lived in the States for 6-7 years and I love it. It's my second home. And it's always easy to have those conversations, but over there, I think the Brits are catching up now. And actually, it's just great that people can talk about, you know, it's okay to talk about wanting to do better or feel better or that you might have issues or that you want to work on and are looking for means and answers that can help you transform or progress or develop. So I think firstly, there's a societal and cultural drive that's allowing that. And then I think people have just started realizing that travel in itself is, you know, it's something I've always thought of, but perhaps people are seeing it differently. It's always been this incredible vehicle to allow and facilitate for absolutely mind-blowing moments that leave an impact on you, not just in that moment when you're there, but long after, that can actually sort of transform a way of thinking or feeling or how you behave. And I think on that note, we've if you look back at travel, was probably for a while, it was very much in a box, and it would be like, well, it's my vacation's coming up. I've got this many days off work. I'm going to go away and I'll lie on a beach because I think it's about relaxing, and that's what lying on a beach does, and I'm busy at work. And you just sort of go through the motions. And then suddenly, as the world's opened up through, you know, more people traveling, but more people being able to discover it through media, through podcasts, through everything being shared. So suddenly people's ability to say, well, actually there are different types of travel that I can actually, you know, meet a feeling I'm pursuing or meet or provide answers to questions I have. I mean, there's a great example here. This is a service we launched 5 or 6 years ago called Bring It Back. And this came, it was a personal thing for me where I've always seen travel as a great vehicle to answer questions that I might have at home, but I never get the time to, no one has the time to answer them. And questions maybe about some of the fundamental building blocks of human life, right? So, you know, and what we were looking at was the fact that if there are amazing communities or cultures around the world who might have a different take on a certain aspect, so it might be their approach to relationships or family or health or love or commerce, and there might be kind of blockages you've got at home, you don't have time to work out how to think about this, it's overwhelming. And you say, well, actually go and spend time in these communities where they have this really beautiful take on this key human building block, and see how that makes you feel, and bring that back home, you know, and pay that into your daily life, and see how that can work. And so we launched it, and it was like spending time in communities in Bhutan who have this really beautiful take on family, on happiness, nomadic tribes in Mongolia where the role of family is so sacred and how they engage with each other, working with entrepreneurs out in Iceland who have this really refreshing take on it. So it was just introducing people to these and showing how actually by traveling, it can start transforming you. And that's been a real, and at the time it was, I hate things like ahead of its time, but it was, and I'd actually really gone deep on Maslow's hierarchy of needs for that, because I was looking at like, how do you get to self-actualization where, you know, you don't need validation from anyone else, you just feel good. Well, you're trying to absorb all the things around you that you can learn from, and you get to that point. And that's what sort of drove Bring It Back that we're doing. But then it's just started increasing into so many other types of travel. But I also think, like I said earlier, I think it's because the conversation about looking for transformation is open. To your point about how do you combat the commoditization of it, and everyone saying, I went there, I've been transformed, or rather, I'm coming here to have this feeling, and I'm surrounded by, I mean, I had a similar experience, you know, 15 years ago in just outside of Cape Town when I was going to go diving with great whites, allegedly, and it was, you know, and it was, yeah, it wasn't a black tomato trip, I was checking out an operator for someone. And, you know, from what they offered to what the reality was, which was sort of 15 boats just kind of like in a big swell of hands by, just waiting for sharks, you know, people being, you know, seasick everywhere. And it was just, you know, it's not that we work with marine biologists down there if you want to do that now, which is a much better way of doing it. But yeah, so then the transformation, though, the point is, it's a very personal thing. So our approach to the company when we're dealing with clients is always to dig into what are their motivations, like what are you looking for, like what matters to you, and actually ask questions that sometimes people just aren't asking of themselves because it hasn't been a conventional way about thinking about travel. Again, goes back to my earlier point, people put travel in a certain box, going, I've got time off, I guess I've got to go and do that, or I'll do that because that's what I've always done, or I assume that's going to be great. But by us kind of asking questions and pulling on a few threads, we start getting people really reflecting on what they really want to get from this trip and what feelings they're really looking for. Like, you know, we started the company, one of the main, you know, philosophies we started Black Tomato was, you know, you might not know, you know, where you want to go, but you know how you want to feel. And so we get, you know, a lot of people getting in touch, we still do. And that's a real kind of, you know, North Star for us, that outlook, because you get people coming to us saying, look, I don't know where, you know, I've got this time off, this sort of budget, but I know that I'm looking for a sense of isolation, or I want to be in awe of nature, or I want to be overwhelmed by a different culture, or I want to be challenged by putting myself out of my comfort zone. And then we start talking, and then it's about connecting them to that feeling, and then maybe looking for a more kind of curated trip. There's different feelings they'll feel. And so the transformation then becomes a very personal thing, without saying, oh, if I replicate that Julia Roberts trip, I shall be transformed. It's more like, you know, that might work for someone, but there'll be, you know, transformation is a multifaceted thing, I think. And it's just helping people to work out what that means to them.
I love it. You guys are like travel therapists or something.
Yeah.
Like
that. Yeah. That often comes up.
So, you know, I've heard you reference fixers a few times. What is a fixer and how does that work?
Yeah. So these are our partners on the ground. So these are, you know, outfits, little companies, individuals who we have built up a network of absolutely crucial relationships. They're an extension of the Black Tomato family, you know. And so we have, over the 20 years we've been running, and even before that, we spent all our time going out and building these relationships with these people who are our guys on the ground. They're part of our team. And all of our travel experts at Black Tomato, they've all lived and traveled extensively in these places, but, you know, they're not always going to be going on a trip with you. So we have our teams on the ground who pull that together. But the crucial thing there is that shared set of values between us and our fixers. So there's lots of people around the world, you know, you can go to, and lots of people say, I can do this, I can do that. And there's lots of good people, but for the types of clients you have, who, like to my earlier point, are a very curious bunch, you know, you need to work with people who really understand those demands, understands the level of needs that our customers have, but also are so dialed into our goals, which about finding the alternatives, you know, finding experiences that connect to emotional outcomes. And there, that's one of the sources of great pride. You know, the purpose of Black Tomato, our purpose is to inspire people through remarkable travel experiences. And when we talk about people in that phrase, it applies to two types of people. One is our clients, one inspired, but the other people within that are the communities and the partners and fixers that we work with, because there is an absolute huge benefit that travel brings to, you know, other places by encouraging people to visit, to learn, they bring in sometimes much needed revenues, and done in a sensitive way, everyone's benefiting. So yeah, it's these fixers, these partners are everything to us. And yeah, we built the business with these guys.
Very smart. Yeah. It's great to know that you've got these, you know, local folks that are boots on the ground, so to speak, who can kind of step in and make sure that.
They are there, and they are, you know, it's a joy, you know, to go back to James and I saying, we just want, how do we keep doing this? Keep traveling. You know, the joy I take now, knowing that sort of pretty much everywhere around the world, I've got, you know, friends who are there, you know, where I go, and they look after, yeah, clients of ours. And when I go there with my family, it's a massive joy.
I love it. So let's talk a little bit about family travel. You know, you and I are both fathers of young daughters.
Yep. Yes.
You know, I'm always thinking about, like, you know, it's all, you're always juggling different people's priorities, right? Like the 10 and 12 year old, the Generation Alpha is actually called the Chief Influence Officer now, because, you know, they're connected, they're on the phone, they are seeing things, they have opinions. A lot of family decisions, if not influence, are outright being driven by this Generation Alpha. But then the parents have needs, and then you've got kids and people want to do different things. So how do you think about that idea of family travel? And I'd be curious to your own experience as a parent. Yeah. How has that shaped the way that you guys design trips for families that have lots of different ideas of what makes a great trip fun?
Yeah. I mean, family travel is such a core market for us. It's a real sense of gravity. We love it because we also recognize the challenge that comes with it, but also that when you get it right, the collective experiences that families have where everyone is happy and feeling fulfilled is so worthwhile. And I think, yeah, the Chief Influence Officer is a really good point. You know, we're seeing in a great way, increasingly, like the influence of children taking on a much deeper sort of factor when it comes to planning the travel. And that's great for us, because we want to hear, you know, from that. We want them to feed into that. And actually, parents are listening. I think the idea that if when you're pulling a trip together, it's only based around one person's desire of what they think is going to be good, you can pretty much guarantee that whilst one person's having a good time, a lot of the other people won't be having a good time. And so what we do is we really go deep into it, the families, about, again, like I talked about earlier, understanding motivations, but understanding also like what's the day-to-day life they have at home. You know, what are the interests, what are the things you dislike? There's the whole logistic side that we'll both know. I know, traveling with kids, you've got to get that right. That's got to be seamless. So if you see some companies that come along and say, we're the family travel guys, and they push out loads of amazing adventures and crazy stuff. And yeah, you're thinking, okay, but you want to know, will the transfer have a car seat in for that kid? Like, will the transfer be too long? Will they have snacks in there? Like, is the jet lag going to affect them? And I mean, many, many years ago, there was a company in the UK who launched a family travel offering. And I remember they sent away a journalist on a big press trip, and the journalist came back and it was, she'd taken her kid away, and it was something like Vietnam, and it was hiking. And she said, yeah, it was a fairly balanced review, but she said, for all that, the most excited her kid was when they got home, they were driving back from Heathrow and they saw a cow, in a field. And I said, yeah. So for all that, yeah. So it's kind of understanding what matters. So for us, it's, we're seeing a lot more now that is a shift from what used to be, I'd say 10 years ago, when you looked at some family travel, it would be like parents like, well, we'll go to this place. We need stuff for the parents, stuff for the kids over there. Kids might enjoy it, might not, but, we'll come together a bit, but that's it. We're now seeing a big shift into this kind of like family, connectivity, doing things together, like going and like starting a new hobby or passion where they can all kind of enjoy it. So like we're getting seeing families like all going to learn to surf together, right? Or they might be going on an art curation trip of Northern Spain, amazing galleries and food in there where, they're at an age where kids get into food more. So we're just finding common threads which they can all enjoy. And so again, that's understanding the family dynamic. I organized as mother-in-law at a trip to Iceland for her birthday, and there were like 20 of us, and that went from people 85 to like 2-year-olds. And you'd think, right, this is going to be tough. But when you know a place and you know the range of things that can be done that can meet the needs of all these people and how you can balance it in between, you end up creating these series of magical experiences. Yes, for certain individuals, certain times, but certain experiences they all enjoy together that then get talked about forever and ever and ever. And that kind of them all being in that moment is key. So we really into it. And that's, as a father of two daughters, that gives me the most satisfaction. I mean, just on that thread, one thing I'll tell you that we did, talking about group travels, sort of related to families, is we've seen since COVID, a lot of these kind of reunions, multi-gen trips, people coming together. And it's often been someone organizing it. And what goes from being like, this is going to be a great trip for everyone together, quickly goes from, after 3 days, like everyone who sort of is going to be love seeing each other, it's like a really painful Christmas where everyone just kind of hates each other, right? Because often it's one person organizing it all. And you're all being taken around on buses, and some people don't want to do that. So we launched a couple of years ago a service called See You in the Moment. And it was it's our take on how to do private group travel, but in a slightly different way. So the idea is we have 5 different categories. So one's about a challenge, one's about a meal, one's about a journey, a celebration, loads of different experiences that are all about coming together for a moment in time. But what we say is, this is the moment in time. So it might be watching the Palio in Siena from a private balcony over there. We're all coming together to watch. It might be mountain biking down the side of Mount Kenya, which you all do together. But in the build up to that, you can all travel or go to places as you want to do differently. So someone might be, if you're in Italy, might be really into the food. So we'll organize food stuff for them. So they're all having their own thing, but then they come together for this moment. So they're really there enjoying that thing together without any of the pain of like, I had to do all that group travel together and I now hate my second move cousin because, they sat on top of me on something. And that's been really special because it's allowed us to create absolutely mind-blowing moments for groups of people all over the world, from like, long lunches in the fjords of Norway where they've sailed up in boats and caught fish, to doing a pilgrimage in Japan where groups come together, but around that they've gone off and done their own travels in Japan. We've organized it all for them, so they had their individual experience, but really focused on that shared collective experience in the moment, being present, which is a really big thing for us this year. We're calling 2026 the year of being fully here. So I think that's an important thing. And I think we need to sort of slow down and take some time. So I could probably talk for hours on family travel, but it's like I say, it's our morning, noon, and night for a lot of the company. So it's a great area to work on.
I love it. When you're advising brands like Sixth Sense and Kurzner, what are some of the gaps that you see that hotels think the travelers want and what they actually deliver?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I'm not saying this because I have the privilege of, you know, being on the advisory boards of these companies, but the reason I am involved is because I love the way they think. What they see and what is about really, it's true of any form of hospitality, but really kind of understanding what matters to the consumer rather than what they think plays well in terms of outward facing, what's been done historically. And I think so much of that, when it comes to properties or hotel groups, is in the people that are in these places in terms of staff and the people working there. There's that famous expression in hospitality about restaurants, like you don't often remember the food, but you never forget the people. And I think that is true. Any great hotel I stay at that I can ever think of, the thing I remember is how the people there made me feel, right? And those brands get it, like Sixth Sense, because you know, you go and stay in any one of them, they take such interest in kind of connection, not overwhelming you, but just how you feel welcomed. And, you know, yes, you know, we can go and stay in some stunning hotels, and they are stunning, but if, you know, you might walk into an amazing room or walk out into a beautiful courtyard or into by a pool, but the moment you engage with someone from there who just leaves you flat or doesn't seem like they care, all that other stuff can fade away. Yeah, and it's just true. I mean, I spent in the summer, I was at the Sixth Sense in Douro Valley in Portugal. And it's a beautiful property, like in the, you know, the region, you know, where all the port comes from. And the thing that I remember most was the way the people welcomed me in, and my daughters still talk about the people there. It was like you were friends. And so I think the hotels getting it right are the ones that leave you with a feeling of being not just welcomed, but settled. You know, I think a bad hotel stay is one where you don't ever feel quite relaxed. And I don't mean if you've got to feel like home, because a good friend of mine, James Lohan, who you know, founded Mr. and Mrs. Smith, says, like, why'd you go to a hotel to make it feel like home? Just stay at home. So, right? It's not about, oh, we'll make you feel like home. It's actually about making you feel relaxed and comfortable, but in a different place, right? And that, by being relaxed and comfortable in a different place, it opens your mind, you can get inspiration. But so much of that is rooted in the people. And gimmicks, you know, you can have the most incredibly developed technology, you know, all the bells and whistles, but if it doesn't make you feel thought of, you know, and it's a big part for me, like luxury is about thoughtfulness. If you don't feel that you've been thought of and it's a genuine care, I think for me personally, that fades away. So I think that's what companies like Sixth Sense and, you know, the brands like One and Only and by Kurzner and even like Syra, the new health brand for Kurzner, which is, you know, amazing, like health and well-being. But again, it's the people that have to actually pull you into that and make you feel settled. So yeah, I'm a big, our world, the travel hospitality service, it's at its heart, it's human driven. And I think it'll always be that way.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I stayed at the Zebra in Tulum not too long ago.
Yeah.
And I got an opportunity with my family to make salsa with the head chef of the restaurant, make mojitos from grinding the sugar cane through the old grind, which is the last thing that survived when the hotel burnt down at a particular
Amazing.
Period. So not only did I get to hear about all the food ingredients of the region and how that's important to the local culture, but I got to hear about the history of the hotel. And I got to hear it from the executive chef. And then by having that experience, you know, then we moved all of our salsa to a table and then they brought out our dinner. And I must have told that story either 100 times at this point, either on this podcast, from a stage somewhere around the world, or just one-to-one to a friend.
And you see, like you say, but see that impact, right, that has on you, right? And that is, I'm sure that's not a kind of dreamt up, you know, corporate driven. It's just something because they're passionate about it. I mean, it's a similar thing. I was staying at a hotel in Paris, very nice, a beautiful hotel. And very well known. And one morning when my daughter, you know, was trying to attack the pastry table, and the waiter came over and said to my daughter, would you like to come and see where the croissants and pastries are made? And they were like, yeah. And so they walked them off into the kitchen, into this incredible kitchen full of all these chefs that passed. These chefs all lit up, and it wasn't for the staff. And they sort of pulled them around and making them croissants, and they still talk about it. I mean, they're desperate to go back, and I don't think I have the budget always to go back. So I'm like, you know, but it was that like, just like, I mean, the salt was amazing, but those sorts of things, they're very hard to kind of, you can't commodify those, and it has to come from a deep innate belief about the power of sharing passions from human to human. And you can see how much that meant to you. And it's a great story. So yeah, long may that continue with the people who are getting it right.
Love it. All right. So AI is trying to transform travel at a rapid rate. You know, we have the idea that we are going to be able to speak to an AI agent, and then suddenly our itinerary and our bookings and our flights and everything will be set up for us and life will be perfect. I think a lot of people are actually having a whipsaw back to, you know, human and in person and real because of AI. When you can't trust your eyes, when you go on social media and you're like, is that real? Is that AI? You know, I know 17-year-olds right now that don't have any social media apps on their phone. So there is kind of this return to the human. In a world where AI is trying to rapidly change the travel industry, how important is that role of humans, especially in luxury?
Yeah, I mean, I've touched upon it already in the conversation. It is everything. I think, look, also, like, I think there is a really great role for AI within luxury to kind of, that goes side by side with the very best of human talents. We have a phrase we use internally called humate, which is about taking the very best of the human side, which is, you know, irreplaceable, you can't replicate, but allowing that to thrive and blossom by supporting it with great technology that can allow people to kind of get rid of some of the mundane or the banal parts of their job or the task, to free them up to be and bring that human magic that will never be replaced. You know, I mean, we benefit from the fact that we're at the end of luxury, which is very bespoke. It's about access. It's about relationships, about crafting experience and delivering those experiences, which AI can never do that. You know, and even if the AI said you should go here, it's not going to have the relationship with the guy that owns the record store down that side street in Sao Paulo that's going to take you to these, you know, it's just these different things. And on the back end of our company, in terms of streamlining process, ability to pull information that we've got in different parts together, freeing up time for our humans to work on the real magic of building connection with the consumer, the clients, establishing that trust. And you're right, we've been tracking AI for a long time. Like I said, like it's in the back end of our company, but it's about using the best of that to amplify and celebrate the best of our humans. And so with we're seeing that as well. Like AI allows people to challenge everything, but when you challenge everything, it also creates uncertainty, right? And when it comes to your vacations or getting it right, and like I say, the stuff we do, you couldn't really do through AI anyway. You might think you get inspiration, but you won't have been tried and tested. You won't have kind of gone to the lengths you've gone, also, like I say, have the access to the creativity. But if someone tries to do a big thing themselves, you know, or book something in, and again, the AI, yes, it might know your background, but it hasn't looked you in the eyes and really understood that. It's a risky take. And what we've seen is people will go onto ChatGPT, might pull together ideas and then come to us and say, can you do that? And we're like, yeah, but have you actually thought about this or that? And luckily ChatGPT seems to like Black Tomato, so often returns us as a kind of an organization to use. And I hope that will continue. But it's not putting your head in the sand and saying, oh, you know, don't want to use it. It's not going to touch us. You know, the world, yeah, it's an AI world we're living in, we'll continue to live in, but it's about finding our place and our value proposition in it. And I think the snapback, we're seeing that as well. You know, I mean, it's, you're seeing like the ban on social media in Australia for under 16s. They're petitioning for it in the UK as well. And I think I've got, you know, extended family members of that age as well, who are sort of just taking time off it. It comes back to also the transformation and the wellness and stuff. You know, there's more and more stuff about taking time out from it. And actually, yeah, I'm not sure I can share this story. I can share this story, but I was at a conference sometime last year, and it was talking about kind of the future of travel. And there were some people from some tech companies there who were talking about, well, you know, it's great because you can go to this place and you can pull out your phone and everything you can look through is augmented reality and it'll tell you everything there. You can also set up an AI friend on your phone and create a personality of, you can say, hey, I want you to be a French, you know, barman who works in the Ray and likes wine, and they'll just chat with you and like walk around the friend. And I said, look, I've got to say, look, I love technology, but this is just ripping the soul out of what travel should be. And I said, if it got to a point where I or my daughters were going away on their own and saying, it's fine, I'll just look at everything through my handheld and I'm not going to talk to a person, then, you know, I give up. Because I'm not saying everyone has to talk to people, but one of the prerequisites or the historically about travel was you travel because you go to open your mind, engage with cultures, learn from people, have experiences that will scare you, inspire you and stuff. And the idea of just walking around cities or landscapes, just looking at this, luckily I don't think, I mean, look, some people will like that. Our customer base and types of people we talk to, that's not for them. And I'll work very hard to keep encouraging that. And like, you know, stuff like Lostin's doing as well is exactly that, right? So it's...
Yeah. No, we're, you know, second city, we're point of view.
Yeah.
You know, when you can't trust your eyes because of AI and, you know, every influencer out there can make a Motel 6 look like a Four Seasons because it's so good at camera work. You know, you can't trust photos, you can't trust videos, but you can trust voices you trust. So
whether it's
a company like you guys that has a 17-year track record, or a company like us that has a 10-year editorial point of view, and people who collect our guides and put them on their table as, you know, things to show their friends, like, people are looking for trusted voices, whether that's on the services side or the media side, I think.
No, I definitely agree. And look, one of the things, again, when we're starting out, if you said, well, who are we as a company? We often said, you know, we want to be the best friend that some of us have or from in those places around the world that you can call up. And it's this trusted friend, right? That you trust them, right, for that recommendation because they know it. So it's you're approachable, you understand each other, but you're informed. And it's that trust that comes from great humans, great editorial that has, you know, been in there, you know, it's turned over the stones, it's looked for things that, you know, people are yearning for. And yeah, I'm reading a lot, like I'm sure you are, about this reaction. I often think about, you know, my daughters are 7 and 5, and I wonder, you know, AI is obviously going to be a huge part of their world, but I wonder in what capacity as they get older, will it, you know, do we get to a level where it's a brilliant enabler for lots of things. It should enable their creativity so they can actually think about things because other things can be done. Like, there's a big trend for us this year is what we call the gift of boredom. So, you know, it's really important. I'm not sure if you've read it, like The Anxious Generation, right? You know, and that book by Jonathan Haidt. And there's this idea about, you know, getting kids off screens, but actually remembering that something that we may now or children or parents might think is conventionally boring because you don't have a screen to look at. If you go back 10 years, 15 years, if I was turning up to meet someone for a coffee and I was early, I was okay, like, just to sit on my own. Like, now you think, if I don't, I'm jonesing for my phone that I don't have. But actually, when you're sat with those thoughts, that's where ideas come and percolate. And so we're saying, like, kids and parents, go away without the screen and put yourself in environments where you can just look and observe. And at a child's level, it's so good for, like, brain development to encourage, like, creativity and imagination, so they're not being zoned out just by scrolling. For adults, we're all overwhelmed day to day by the constant connectivity and always being on and always having to, like, respond and living in a sea of ephemeral moments. When you go away, go and get bored and see the magic that will happen. So and again, goes back to being present. So yeah, we're launching a campaign soon, which is basically called This Is Boring. Hoping that will resonate.
I think it will. You know, I when I'm traveling and I need to leave my phone in the hotel, you know, at least for an afternoon to charge. Or even sometimes, you know, if we're like, oh, my phone's kind of low on batteries right now, we're going on this tour for a couple of hours, I'm just going to leave my phone. And yeah, like there's a part of me, especially as a travel media person, that's like, yeah, oh, I'm not capturing the moment, yeah, on film. But, you know, maybe my wife is, or one of my daughters are. We don't all need to be on at the same time. But or even little moments like what you were talking about, like showing up to a coffee shop, like if my phone isn't charged, I'll leave it in the car to charge. And then I'll walk in 15 minutes early and I'll have to sit there for 15 minutes and look at people or read, yeah, the newspaper, whatever it is, while I wait for my appointment to show up. And you know, there was a period of time where I was actually leaving my phone in my office on Sundays, and that was, yeah, that was radical, and it didn't last long. But
yeah, I've been down a couple of days. I did for a while last year, where in the morning I dropped like my eldest daughter at school and I'd come back. There's a little cafe near my house and I would leave my stuff at home, go down and just buy a newspaper and for 15 minutes just read. And although it was consumed, it was just, you know, you take more time, you think a bit about more. And because it's like there wasn't something that I can go and grab, you know, I'm not sort of just skimming through and actually just lent into it more. So trying to get a few of those things into your daily life, I find's been good. But yeah, I think like travel's a great vehicle for, you know, I mean, again, like we, you know, I remember talking to a very good friend of mine who's a guide in Iceland, you know, and he wasn't our clients, but it was someone else who was looking after, and they had their family trip. And they were, you know, the great thing about Iceland, you take these super jeeps, and although it's a big country, move around, but one of the joys of moving around Iceland, these super jeeps, is you're going through these landscapes that blow your mind. So it's not like, oh, it's a transfer. It's like kind of off-roading over glaciers and hinterlands and across rivers, but on the way somewhere. But for the whole journeys, there were like these three children who were just on their iPads the whole time.
Oh,
and he sort of said to the mom, he's like, do they want? And she's like, oh, no, I don't want to have to deal with them. But it's like they are driving through God's own country, like one of the most magnificent landscapes on earth. And he said, I honestly reckon they probably saw 20% of what they went through. And look, each their own. I'm definitely, it sounds like I'm judging. I'm not. Everyone's on their own journey managing kids. Like, trust me, it's like, you know, I'm definitely being that person, you know, in the busy pub when kids are having a meltdown. You're like, oh, I don't want to do it. And I always just like, just look at this. But if there's an effort, and particularly when you're traveling, to say, look, eyes up, put that away. Yeah, at the end of each day, there's that thing in, there's that book by the psychologist Fred Bryan, which talks about savoring, about how to really be in a moment and enjoy that moment. And he says, it's like our life is all about, we're raised basically almost into this world of anxiety because we're told don't do this because something bad will happen, or don't do that. And no one, it's a brilliant thing, he says, no one when you're young as a kid ever comes up to you and says, really enjoy that ice cream, God, I just love it, dig in. It's always about don't do that. And he has this thing where at the end of every day, he'll say to his kids, like, what was the best thing that happened to you today? You know, when they're traveling. I tried doing it at home when they're knackered after school. They're just like, go away, daddy. but yeah, not now. But when we travel, at the end of each day, we're like, okay, what have you loved today? And it's just amazing seeing their eyes light up and go, oh, you know, did this. And it's sort of just planting those and reminding them, you know, and that's what I see my kids. They just, you know, they remember these things, especially, but also because you're trying to kind of get them to, without forcing it, you know, young brains, but kind of recognize it. So it's, yeah, hopefully that will, yeah, we'll do more of that this year.
I love it. So you've traveled extensively throughout your career and life. Is there a place that you've been that you would recommend to the Lost In audience to go explore that comes to mind quickly?
Yeah, you could probably tell from this conversation, Iceland is I must have been 20-25 times. It's like my second home, and every time I go back, there's more to fall in love with. It's brilliant any time of the year, from the dark winters to the endless summer nights. The people are amazing, the art, music, food, the landscapes, it's everything. It's romantic, it's great for fun, it's a joyous place. And I feel very, very lucky that I get to go there often. And when I lived in New York, my now wife, she was living in London, and we'd often meet.
I love that.
But I mean, look, I'm very lucky in the job I have that I get to see a lot of places, and there's lots of other places that I absolutely adore. But if I could only have one, like perennially, it'd be Iceland.
I love it. Where is on your list of places to check out this year? Where do you want to go next?
Where do I want to go? I want to go. I'm not sure if I'll be able to get there, but there's amazing. I met a guy who is Mongolian, and we do a lot in Mongolia. I've never been. I did a train route from Moscow, the Trans-Siberian Express, which went sort of across the top. I've never been in, but we do a lot out there. But I met a guy whose family are generations old from the Mongolian steppe, and they have there's a sacred valley they have that's 10 hours out from Ulaanbaatar, and it's wild horses and trekking, and it just it's sometimes you might have it as well. Sometimes you can, and it's a terrible thing to say, but you see so much stuff the whole time. You can sometimes become desensitized. And I don't mean that in a bad way. And other people, they'd be like, wow. And you're like, ah, yeah, it's cool. And I mean that. But because we're lucky to see so much. But I had this conversation with him over a coffee in London. And on it's the first time in a long time, like my jaw was on the floor for the whole time. And I was like, ah. And he ended it with like, look, we've got to get you out this summer. I was like, be careful what you say, because I'm definitely going to come. But yeah, that one is. I mean, I love cities. But also these, like a bit from the Iceland thing, that the great wilderness is when you're stood out there, that a tiny speck, just marveling at the expanse and might of our world. That's the stuff that stays with me.
I love it. Well, Tom, thank you so much for an epic conversation. Appreciate you sharing more about your story, your extensive travels, and the Black Tomato brand with the Lost In audience. If you could point people to learn more about what you're up to these days, where would you like to send the audience?
Please jump onto our website, blacktomato.com, and you can find us on Instagram and Black Tomato as well. Yeah, lots going on there. And Dylan, thanks so much for having me on. I really enjoyed the conversation, and it's been great to share some stories and hear your stories as well.
Love it. Thanks, buddy. And for those of you who are watching at home, if this is the first time you're seeing the show, don't forget to give us a subscribe. An honest review on whatever podcast platform you might be listening is how we find a bigger audience. And last but not least, if you know somebody in the world who might enjoy the travel conversation that I had with Tom today, don't forget to share the show. With that, I'll wish you a great day. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.